The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're going to see Finland taking care of its share, but of course trying to ask others to do the same, just because that's the goal that has been agreed upon between NATO allies. And it's only normal that Finland will be asking for others to do the same thing, what we are also doing. But then we also get to the other aspect, which is interesting, that Finland, even though it takes its national defense seriously, you're not looking at a nation of warmongers. I think you're looking at a country that is more of a, in the sense of verify and then trust mentality, that Finns use their defense force as a last resort, but also as a strategic signal to, in this case, Russia, that it's not really worth it.
I'm David Preece, publisher of Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare podcast for April 6th, 2023. Finland is in NATO. This week, the ratification was made complete, and the country joined the North Atlantic Alliance. To talk through how it got there, I sat down with two research fellows at the Finnish Institute for International Affairs in Helsinki. One is Henry Van Hannon, who has also served as a foreign policy advisor to the National Coalition Party, which recently won the most seats in the Finnish parliament and is in the process of forming a government. And we spoke with Minna Aulander, who is a research fellow also at FIIA, and like Henry, has recently written for Lawfare and been on the podcast previously to talk about Finnish security issues. We talked about the long road to get to NATO membership for Finland. We talked about what Finland brings to NATO and what NATO brings to Finland. It's the Lawfare Podcast, April 6th. Finland joins NATO. Henry and Minna, I feel like we're getting the band back together because in May of last year, we spoke along with one of our colleagues from Sweden about the application of Finland to NATO and the application of Sweden to NATO. And I wanted to talk with both of you again, because now we are allies. Congratulations to us and to you as full NATO members. Sweden is not there yet, but we're going to focus on the Finnish side of things. Henry, back in that conversation last year, we were talking about the prospects for membership, what it would mean strategically, politically, militarily, but also the time frame. And the three of us weren't quite sure what was going to happen. We knew that Hungary and Turkey were going to be some level of obstacle, but we didn't quite know what it meant. As I recall, I was more optimistic, thinking that this would move relatively quickly. What do you recall about your thinking from April of last year through that conversation up to today? Has this played out at each phase the way that you thought it would, or have you been surprised with some of the developments?
Well, I personally tried to divide the process in my mind into sort of three acts. The first act being securing the path to NATO, making sure that you have the support of your allies and potentially the security guarantees from the moment you start preparing for the application and when you send it. And then you enter into Act 2, which is the actual ratification process, where you have to the sort of gray zone that we were afraid that would turn out to be somehow harmful or dangerous because we were not sure how Russia would react. Now we have seen later on that Russia was basically busy occupying other countries.
Right.
So that was the sort of the end of Act 2 now, that we have seen just as Finland joined NATO. And then we enter into Act 3, which is actually implementing NATO membership and actually being a NATO member. Now, certainly this Act 2, I think we were quite optimistic about getting very close by the end of last year, potentially to 28 or 29, depending on what sort of a problem would Hungary turn out to be. Mm-hmm. Well, now we saw that it actually turned out to be perhaps not a bigger problem than we thought, but potentially more linked to Turkish decision. And for me, when I decided to visit both Ankara and Budapest in February this year, it was really revealed to me in a different way that there's a clear and strong link between Turkey and Hungary on this decision. And I think the estimation for me was that when we start hearing that Hungary will ratify, that most likely means Turkey has also made a decision to move on. And I think this is the exact same choreograph that we're going to see in terms of the Swedish application as well in the near future.
I do want to come back to your experiences in Hungary and Turkey recently, but Mina, same question to you, because in our conversation that we had on the podcast here a few months ago, I recall that in a rare event, someone was more skeptical than I was, and you were skeptical that Turkey at least, but possibly even Hungary, would move on Finland's NATO invitation before the elections and before the results were known and a new Finnish government was formed. And here we are. We've had the election. As we record this, the new government is in the process of forming, one presumes. But we have Finland in NATO. So talk about your thoughts from last spring through the year and into this year, whether you think that you were surprised at various stages up to and including Turkey turning around relatively quickly there at the end to approve the membership.
Yeah, I think Henry's analysis was quite good about these different acts or stages of the process. And for my part, I have to say that at first I was somewhat surprised, actually, that Erdogan gave in on the initial objections before the Madrid summit, surprisingly quickly and kind of easily. And I had expected him to maybe even drag that on for a bit longer, but then like Finland and Sweden actually did manage to get the invitee status already at the Madrid summit. And in a way, I can totally understand that at that point, it was definitely Turkey's best bet to make sure that terrorism stays on NATO's agenda. There was a real danger that it would be all about Russia at the Madrid summit. And it was a very important summit because the new strategic concept was decided on there. So I can understand from a strategic perspective that this was a very good bargaining chip in that sense for Turkey. And then I think after that, and especially with the incredible unprecedented speed with which other NATO member states ratified Finland and Sweden's membership, then I made the mistake of underestimating Turkey's ability to withstand pressure from allies. Mm-hmm. And I got kind of disillusioned later in the fall when I was talking to NATO officials and they said like, oh, don't you worry, that they do this all the time. So they can keep going like this. And then that really kind of made me realize that probably it's really not so much about the perceptions of other allies, because I think that this process was very much for Turkey about presenting itself as this kind of important and independent ally and within NATO, like underlining its important strategic position and so on. So it even, from that perspective, it even made certain sense to just like oppose everyone else and be like, yes, but this is our position and it must be respected. And then, as you correctly remembered, I was quite pessimistic when we last spoke about this, because in the beginning of the year, it was quite a frustrating moment. It looked like there was a big setback in the process due to the incidents in protests in Sweden that very much angered Erdogan on a probably very personal level, and that can't be underestimated in this case, unfortunately. And at that point, I didn't really see, I had the feeling that the process was kind of really set back by weeks, because then at the trilateral talks were paused for a while and so on. But I think what was key here and why Finland in the end now went ahead and also managed to secure the ratifications from both Hungary and Turkey. So the key was to agree on separating the processes. And that was the most difficult question from the Finnish perspective, like whether we should or not go for that. And that was something that Erdogan actually indicated when Niinistö visited him in Ankara to get this final, promise from president to president that the ratification will be done. So Erdogan had indicated that they were just waiting for Finland to signal that we are willing to go ahead without Sweden. And although it was not, and Niinistö actually emphasized that it was not done on the official level, Finland never said like, yes, we want to go without Sweden. But it was enough to just do our own part of the ratification, the parliamentary vote and everything, and then say like, well, no, it's not in our hands anymore. So that was obviously the signal. I think that in the end, the solution was something of a compromise. Like we didn't get to join together hand in hand as we wished with Sweden. But hopefully Sweden will follow in not too distant future, and then we will at least get to join right after each other, if not together. And then that would be maybe an acceptable compromise for both, because then also Turkey can say, or Erdogan can say, okay, we managed to separate them. They had to kind of oblige to our wishes. And at least that could be a perspective.
Yes. Henry, back to Budapest and Ankara. In your travels there, I'm really curious how you feel about the conversations you had and the mood you had, because on the one hand, the obstinance, if you will, of Hungary and Turkey compared to the other members of the alliance does raise some questions, and it does leave, as we say, a bad taste in one's mouth about the delay in the approvals. On the other hand, they have approved Finland's membership and they are full allies, and the Finnish government and people are committed to the defense of Turkey and Hungary now as part of this alliance relationship. And one does not want to hold grudges when one is in such a relationship. So how do you balance that out, having been in these discussions and spoken with people that probably both frustrated you and gave you some faith that this was going to work out?
I think the visit in early February to both of these countries came at an interesting time. It was, like Minna mentioned, it was just after the Quran burning incidents and the halting of the trilateral discussions between Finland, Sweden, and Turkey. And of course, for that reason, the visits actually gained some domestic interest as well and some attention back home. The idea was to travel to these countries, knowing that, of course, we have a process that's still ongoing, but also trying to understand that these are two future allies that perhaps see certain things a bit differently than we in Finland and probably broader within NATO, and trying to get a better understanding of the strategic thinking in these countries was the purpose, also the sort of important purpose behind the trip. And for me, it sort of gave the impression that even though most of us here in Northern Europe and Western Europe, especially in Central, Eastern and Northern European countries, are very focused on the threat coming from Russia and how to manage that threat, it's not the same case for Turkey and not even Hungary. I think these are two countries that are combined with a foreign policy approach that certainly doesn't try to hide the fact that they are maximizing their, or trying to maximize their national interest. And even that, even in cases when that might come at the expense of others, for example, Hungary doesn't send arms to Ukraine, but other NATO countries are doing that. Right. And for me, for example, I learned that for the Hungarians, their foreign policy, they perceive it through Berlin, Moscow, the Western Balkans and Ankara. So that's where their focus points lie on. And for me, this siding with Erdogan by Orban, it seems like that this is not a case about objecting NATO enlargement per se. And the same goes to Turkey. This was about trying to gain something out of this. We, of course, knew that there was the feud on EU funds between the EU Commission and Hungary. But still, I mean, it seems that Orbán here is trying to make, and is still trying to, with Sweden, to do a favor for Erdogan, which he can then later on try to get back. Hungary is the junior partner in this delay and has been in this delay process. I think that this whole order of things has been set by Turkey. Once Turkey decides to move, then Hungary follows suit. Now in Turkey, it was interesting. It sort of gave you the understanding that in Finland we have basically one existential threat, and that's Russia. You're otherwise surrounded by neighboring friendly countries. But then with the case of Turkey, you have to look at that environment a bit differently. There's you know, Iran, there's Syria, there's the Mediterranean, there's the Black Sea and all these issues. And then you have Russia. So it's a bit different approach and different strategic culture. And I think it's a good thing to try to understand that. It doesn't completely explain the delay. I think for the Turks, it seemed a bit more principled, the objection that they really wanted us to understand that you must take the issues of terrorism and PKK seriously and how they operate and potentially finance actors through Finland. But then it seemed to be more of a case that this is going to be solved eventually in discussions between NATO and Turkey and NATO and Washington, D.C., even though we know that the U.S. doesn't want to take a formal role of being a sort of mediator in this process. We do know that it definitely has an important role to play. Mm-hmm. But one last important point was that the mood in Turkey when we visited in the early weeks of February was that Finland is not a problem anymore, that we are ready to ratify Finland if Finland gives us the signal. And it was interesting that when we came back to Finland and gave some interviews to domestic media, we got some backlash for saying these things. But it turned out that just a month later on, this is exactly what happened. So, I mean, this was the mood in Turkey already in the early months of this year.
The terrorism concerns are, of course, real, and they are a real security problem in Turkey. And as Henry just described, the security environment, it's very different than ours up here with Russia as the single threat. And in a way, it makes it easier for the, let's say, northern flank countries to unite and rally around, let's say, the NATO flag now, because we have this very clear threat environment and threat perception of the one threat that is very prevalent. And obviously the whole southern flank threat environment is much more diffuse. This is not only the case for Turkey, but also France, Italy, and other southern European NATO allies. But I think that we have to also see this, and I think this is a mistake we made in Finland and especially Sweden, that we took this way too personally, because this is not the first time that Turkey has done this. It was the same case, for example, with the Baltic defense plans in 2019 and 20, and it was about Syria. It had nothing to do with the Baltic states or any objections that Turkey could have conceivably had against their defense plans. So it was again linked to Turkey's different security interests than the ones at stake in the process. So they just have this like habit and kind of this negotiation strategy of leveraging like unrelated issues. And just like Hungary as well tried to do this issue linkage between the EU and NATO. It didn't work out because Hungary just doesn't have the same position as Turkey has. They don't have the same leverage as Turkey has within NATO and also within the EU. Hungary is increasingly isolated with its blockage of also Ukraine aid and so on. But I think that this is also important to keep in mind that while like Sweden kind of provided the perfect ground to project these real security concerns on, it was still probably much more about something else. And now I think that the earthquake in Turkey played quite a big role in how this came about now, because the Turkish people simply lost interest, absolutely understandably, on the Finnish and Swedish NATO membership. Like that was just simply not relevant for them in a situation where like this catastrophic earthquake just happened in their country. And then like Erdogan lost some of the value that this issue had previously, also with view to the negotiation, the elections coming up. And I think that Probably it was all the time part of this game that there will be the elections, and this is like one thing that he can use as a card in the election, going up to the election. So I think Turkey is a very complicated case in the sense that nothing is as straightforward as we would like to take it. And I think on the Finnish part, this was also like for both Finland and Sweden, it was a big, maybe even culture shock in the sense that this is a very different way of playing hardball in a sense with hard security like than what we are used to. For Sweden, it's hard because they have had this long normative foreign policy tradition. And for Finland, we tend to be very sincere and take agreements very seriously and promises very seriously. So then like this kind of backpedaling on promises and then shifting goalposts and everything, this is very hard for both Finland and Sweden to navigate. So I think there were like many kind of different strains in this whole game. And it's not over yet, of course. The elections in Turkey are a big question mark what will happen, like, because Erdogan isn't like so secure in his position right now, and what will that mean then if he loses the election? These are very difficult questions considering Sweden's accession prospects.
Very true. I'd like to talk about the implications for Finland of NATO membership, and also the implications for NATO of Finland's membership. And I'd like to get thoughts from both of you, and I'll use as a structure for this the framework that was set up, Mina, in the article that you wrote, the comment on the Finnish Institute of International Affairs site with some of your colleagues talking about Finland's NATO accession, where you wrote that at least four significant implications were present for Finnish security and defense policy with NATO membership. I'll use that framework, but I'll turn to Henry first to talk about the first two of these significant implications that you wrote about, and then get you to weigh in as well. One of them is the fact that Finland has to learn to become a genuine collective defense actor, not focused solely on resilience and national defense, but also on the collective defense of the enlarged alliance. And as a parallel to that Finland will significantly deepen its existing military partnerships. Henry, from your perspective, is Finland poised to do well on both of these fronts relatively soon?
I would like to think so, because if you take it for starter, certain things, you look at the capabilities that we have in all domains, the modernized capabilities, you look at Finland spending the 2% GDP target set by NATO in the Wales summit, and then you look at Finland's location as an Arctic and Baltic country, Baltic Sea country, that sort of puts Finland in a position where it's actually potentially a significant influencer within NATO, that it will have contribution, and if it pulls its strings quite well, it's actually in a very good position to advance its own interests that also support NATO interests. And I think in this sense, you mean that we can talk about Finland as sort of a potentially taking the role of a coach within NATO, that as an example of encouraging others to invest in defense as well, to participate in burden sharing, because we're not, I mean, with or without Trump, the discussion on burden sharing, it's always been there, and it will continue to be there as well. And especially in circumstances where we see a Russia that is very different compared to the Wales summit 2014. Now we see a Russia that's launching a full-scale war against its neighbor. Mm-hmm. This definitely, I mean, creates some requirements for NATO countries to do more on defense. And I think Finland is going to be one of the countries that is going to ask others to do the same that we are also doing. Because, you know, we don't want to see a scenario where people will say, well, now Finland, you got admitted to NATO in a historically fast pace. Now you can take care of, you know, the rest of the countries also in this region. That's not going to be what I think Finland desires. What Finland would like to see is efficient command structures for regional security in Northern Europe, and also to have a specialization between these countries, definitely looking at Germany here right now as a Baltic Sea country, to contribute more, and also to just do what is promised and what is agreed upon. And I think this is a role that's coming to suit Finland quite well. I mean, in the EU, Finland is not potentially a major actor, but within NATO, Finland actually can have that position if it plays its cards right. And now the other thing that you just mentioned, the second point about regional cooperation, I think it's more or less evident that Finland will definitely continue very close bilateral, trilateral defense cooperation with Sweden, with Norway, with the Baltic countries, including the Brits and also the Americans in a suitable way, because we see that there is, I mean, we can't escape the fact that there's also some uncertainty around the commitment of NATO allies in the next 10, 15, 20 years. We don't know what the state of the alliance will be. Of course, it is in the interest of Finland to pursue defense policy that supports NATO's ability to execute collective security in this region and in a way that also supports Finnish national security interests, because you cannot forget that we are a border state. If a crisis comes around where Finland would need assistance or need to coordinate efforts together with allies, we don't have days or weeks to think about this. I mean, it could be a matter of hours for a border state. Since day one, when the conflict starts, you're going to, and I hate to say this, but you're going to see people killed. And this makes it a vital interest for Finland to make sure that the arrangements through NATO actually function in all scenarios. And this, I think, requires efficient regional cooperation.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story.
that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then DeleteMe comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. DeleteMe sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate DeleteMe, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
I will point out here, before I get your take on the same question, Mina, that the framework has been laid for this kind of collective defense actor role and the deepening military partnerships because of the developments that, Mina, you wrote about for Lawfare this week about the expanded Nordic cooperation over the past few years on many military and security fronts. And then, of course, even back to last fall in October, when the Finnish and Swedish officials for the first time took part in a NATO defense ministers meeting as observers. So there's already the institution building going on even before formal membership. So Mina, I'll ask you the same question on those two elements of the implications for Finnish security and defense policy from joining NATO. What thoughts do you have on the collective defensive actor role and on the military partnership side of things?
So this is quite a significant change for Finland, especially in terms of kind of mentality and this kind of doctrine, because we have had this very strongly territorial defense focused doctrine, which is of course about our own national security. And it's great because it's a rare commodity in Europe these days. So the fact that Finland actually never went for this expeditionary force model in the beginning of the 2000s, by the way, which was also partially a result of Finland not being a NATO ally at that time. And that was also why NATO wasn't so much considered to be, or NATO membership wasn't so much considered to be in Finland's interest, for example, in the early 2000s, because NATO had so strongly this orientation and focus on out-of-area crisis management operations. And that was that requires different kind of capabilities than Finland has. Of course, Finland has also been participating in crisis management operations like Afghanistan and other out-of-area operations. But still, the focus has in Finland always been on the territorial defense. And then, like, going from this thinking that has really persisted for 80 years, that we have to always be at all times kind of ready to defend ourselves on our own, and we can't expect any help. It's a huge, like, 180 degrees change to then become part of a larger alliance, become like, start thinking of like one for all and all for one. And this raises the question of the level of political ambition in Finland, because this can go many ways. Like, Finland has the potential to become, as Henri outlined, a very like important ally and also a very influential ally. But it also depends on how, in terms of shaping Finnish NATO policy, where the goals are set. Will Finland mostly focus on its own territory and making sure that we still, that we are, like, you know, keeping our promise of, like, not outsourcing it to NATO, and, like, which is very self-evident if you ask anyone in Finland. But in a way, now that we have become an ally, that can't be our only offer. Our only offer as a NATO member can't be that we continue to protect our own territory and the eastern border, because then others can ask, like, well, why did we then want to have this border in the first place? So then there's a question, like, the second tier of ambition level could be maybe focusing very strongly on the regional security and the regional security arrangements, and becoming a very important regional actor, which Finland is very likely to be and already is. And that is kind of an easy one, especially because we already have all these regional cooperation frameworks and arrangements in place. But then the question is, like, what then? Like, what after that? Like, will we actually widen our horizon to view at least the even further European territory? Like, what if, like, of course, for us, the Russia contingency is the one that we are most interested in as NATO ally. But what if it doesn't materialize in our region, in the Baltic Sea region? What if it materializes in the Black Sea region? And to be honest, because we have such good conditions here, or good possibilities to develop a very firm and robust deterrence and defense posture in this region, which will stabilize the region, make it more secure, and thus also a Russian aggression in this region less likely. But the Black Sea region is already quite fragile, quite unstable. It offers a perfect ground for Russia to take the next steps if as soon as it has the capability or capacity from Ukraine. So this is, I think, an interesting question. Like, will we be able to think further outside our own regional box about these things? Of course, the NATO 360 degrees is even a different level again. But this is something. And then there might be some expectations, of course, from our southern flank allies, especially Turkey, of course, now, that we will continue to take also Turkish and southern flank allies' security concerns seriously and show some presence there, maybe, and show that we understand and that we are also prepared to do that, and we are not only here, like, we didn't only join NATO in our pure self-interest, which may very well be the case, but to at least demonstrate that we understand what we joined. So I think this is something that remains to be seen, like which ambition level the Finnish NATO policy will take.
Thank you. I'd like to briefly also touch on the other two elements of the framework that you wrote about, and these build on the shift that traditionally successive governments in Finland have emphasize the importance of maintaining dialogue with Moscow, but now Finland's Russia policy will increasingly be deterrence-based, and one element of that being, of course, that Finland will be covered by the alliance's nuclear umbrella. So, Henry, what are your thoughts about that shift from a long-term pattern of communication between the senior-most levels of the government, but shifting to more of a deterrence psychology when it comes to Russia in particular?
I think we have to look at the longer arc of things when it comes to Finland and Russia and the relationship that has been unfolding for a little over 100 years now since Finland gained its independence in 1917. I think we see a clear pattern that is colored by the fact that this is a very imbalanced relationship between Finland and Russia. The other one is at least a regional superpower, and the other one is a small state. And I think former Finnish foreign minister, Mr. Timo Soini, once said that Finland is the size of itself in Russian foreign policy. But I coined the phrase as saying that the problem is that Russia is the size of itself in Finnish foreign policy. And this is the imbalance. And I think if you look at Finnish history, you know, whether it be Finland declaring independence at a moment when Russia was weak after the First World War in 1917, or when Finland pursued to have this border state alliance in the 1930s, in the pre-Second World War years, and aligning with Germany to fend off the Soviets and gain back the lost territories in the Second World War, opting for neutrality in order to keep the Soviets at an arm's length and avoiding becoming a complete satellite for the Soviet Union, and then quickly applying for the European Union after the Soviet Union collapsed and sort of entered the West. So I would say that NATO sort of falls in line with this tradition of Finland trying to find a balance, trying to sort of narrow down the gap between the security gap that has been always around in the relationship between Russia and Finland. And in this sense, it perhaps represents a shift, but I would say it's more of a getting a new way of managing this imbalance between Russia and Finland, trying to manage the potential threat by Russia to Finland. Because, you know, nothing will fundamentally change in the sense that if you look at the Finnish Defense Forces, I don't think they have exercised anything else except the potential threat coming from Russia. I mean, this has always been the sort of basic understanding in Finland. This was the same case after the Cold War. Finland didn't sort of completely buy into the peace dividend thinking, unlike, for example, Sweden, and has maintained its conscription system. It has maintained a credible national defense. So these issues sort of come from the collective historical memory of the Finns. And in this sense, of course, I mean, Finns reflect how Russians behave. And if Russia is attacking its neighboring countries, then Finland will react and trying to sort of gain and maximize its own security. It's exactly the same words that the president used when Finland joined NATO in the ceremony, that every country tries to maximize their own security. And this is the case with Finland. And with this knowledge on Russia, I think it's, for now, it's going to be on the shelf. You know, Finland has, since the current president, Mr. Niinistö, has been in office since 2012, has been able to have this very close dialogue on the highest levels of Russian power, with basically meeting Putin twice a year, usually at least once in Moscow and once in Helsinki, and then, you know, various other phone calls and meetings elsewhere on other platforms. So this knowledge is not going to disappear. I think it's going to be of you know, use to NATO. It's going to be a benefit to NATO to have a NATO ally that has experience and also potentially has access to Russia when needed. And, you know, at some point after this war ends, and it will end, we're going to have to sit down with the Russians. And at that point, the Finnish access and, you know, the Finnish know-how can be of use. We do know that even at this very moment, you know, there's still embassy-level contacts. There's the long border between Finland and Russia, which needs to be managed regardless of the current sort of general mood in the relationship. So there are still some existing formats. But I would also like to point out one important fact that, you know, usually when you say that a country has a close relationship with Russia and has dialogue with Putin, that sort of has a bad sound, you know, in it. It has a bad connotation. But in this case, I'll leave you with the example of if Finland would have had this relationship and it would have had sort of some sort of corruption or shadow elements to it, then I don't think that the Americans would have sold Finland JASSM missiles back in 2012 before any other NATO allies. I mean, it just sort of represents the nature of this. It's about keeping an eye on your neighbor for your own sake and then potentially telling your allies what your neighbor thinks.
That's right. And for listeners who are interested in these points about the long time understanding of Russia and the high level relationship with Russia, I will point people to Henry's article on Lawfare from a few months ago in January on Finland in 2023, which offers some background on this. Mina, your take on this. What about the psychological and societal shift from this pattern to one of deterrence as part of this alliance relationship?
There has been, like Henry, I think, pointed it out quite well that there has been a shift, but also some continuity, and it's not quite as sudden as it looks from the outside. So the shift has been going on for a longer time. And of course, already like 2014, the annexation of Crimea, like the first invasion of Ukraine, was already a significant moment, and that triggered this process in Finland of starting to build the even closer cooperation with NATO and other bilateral and also in multilateral formats with regional and US and UK partners. So I think that what really changed quite fundamentally as the result of Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine is that Finns have seen to an unprecedented extent the brutality that Russia is willing to use against Ukrainian civilians. And also maybe because I think especially in contrast with the, let's say, the three Baltic states, our southern neighbors, the links to Russia have been closer on the societal level in the sense that more people speak Russian in the Baltic states than in Finland, follow Russian media and society and developments closer than in Finland. There simply has not been that high level of interest on the societal level in like whatever happens in Russia. Finland has always been more, or at least since the Cold War, more like westward oriented, like more interested in what happens in Sweden than in Russia and so on. Like, so although we have had always this, like as Henry described, this like also security and pragmatic interest in knowing what's going on with Russia, it has not been so much on the societal level. And I think that has made maybe Finns like more willing to give, let's say, ordinary Russians the benefit of doubt than, for example, in the Baltic states, who have been in a way, let's say, more anti-Russian already before this invasion. And I think that is quite like the shock of the brutality of this invasion, even if it hasn't been exactly a surprise necessary, but still a shock. I think that has changed the way how Finnish people view Russia as well. And I think that is quite an important change. And also because Finland used to have kind of this approach like speak softly but carry a big stick, so meaning that the official rhetoric about Russia was quite cautious and you wouldn't like officially address the threat that Russia poses, although you were always, we've always been prepared for that possibility. So I think now maybe what is said and what is done matches more in Finland in a way that the also the public rhetoric on the highest level and this kind of openly addressing Russia as a threat, that is quite a significant change. And of course, there was this like, this showed just like very clearly, and that was remarkable how quickly the Finnish society and people understood it. Because in the end, the NATO process was very much from like bottom up. The public opinion changed first and then politics followed. So it just made very clear that we do need to maximize our deterrence because we cannot rely on Russia's goodwill or good faith. Because what Henry also mentioned, that there is this fundamental imbalance in the relationship. It's not a relationship between equals. And although Finland, just like any other neighboring country of Russia, has a vital interest in peaceful relations, but Russia does not view it necessarily the same way. It views everything in this grand scheme of great power competition that it sees itself in with the US and NATO and so on. And then if it suits Russia then, or doesn't suit Russia, then under the bus Finland goes. So in that sense, I think that was the very clear thing. Like Finland really tried everything the good way, like tried to have as good and cooperative neighborly relations as possible. But then it just kind of became clear last year that this is currently not an option and we need to be absolutely sure that Russia knows very exactly where the border between Finland and Russia is.
Mm-hmm. I would like to close with thoughts from both of you on the other side of this, which is what Finland brings to NATO. And my first guess at this is that most American listeners, but many others don't understand that this really is an asset to the alliance, ranging from Finland's very strong artillery corps to its robust intelligence and Air Force capabilities, the latter, including the recent purchase of 64 F-35As, as well as the strong and already largely interoperable with NATO presence and deployed capabilities in the Baltic Sea itself. So Henry and then Mina, I'd like to hear both of you make the case that Finland is making NATO stronger. And in what ways do you think this will become most clear?
Well, I can start with a list of things, some of the things that you just mentioned. But first to say, you have a wartime strength of 280,000, a reserve up to 900,000. You have a modernized Air Force, as you mentioned, 64 F-35s coming in a couple of years, starting from 2026 and fully operationally capable in 2030. Then you have just modernized your Navy vessels. You have the Western Europe's largest artillery. You have a country that has over 80% of willingness to defend their country regardless of the outcome. Just to give you sort of an idea and the listeners that you're getting in a country that takes its national defense seriously, has never really dropped the ball on the subject, and will continue to take its national defense seriously. A country that doesn't ask you to do things for them. You're going to see Finland taking care of its share, but of course trying to ask others to do the same, just because that's the goal that has been agreed upon between NATO allies. And it's only normal that Finland will be asking for others to do the same thing, what we are also doing. But then we also get to the other aspect, which is interesting, that Finland, even though it takes its national defense seriously, you're not looking at a nation of warmongers. I think you're looking at a country that is more of a, in the sense of verify and then trust mentality, that Finns use their defense force as a last resort, but also as a strategic signal to, in this case, Russia, that it's not really worth it. And then what you're looking at else is the, if you look at where Finland is located as a Baltic Sea and Arctic country, and if you look at some of the war games that, for example, Rand played right after Russia's first invasion of Ukraine in 2014, I think it quite clearly indicated that if NATO were to defend its allies in the Baltic Sea, mainly the Baltic countries, in an efficient way, it would most likely need the airspace, the maritime space, the land of Finland and Sweden to do that. So you're basically, when you involve Finland and Sweden, you actually tilt the balance in favor of NATO so that it actually raises the threshold for this region to become a flashpoint for any future crises. So if you're looking at a war, a hypothetical war between NATO and Russia, it most likely will not start from Northern Europe if we are able to execute the planning and exercising of the defense of NATO in this part of the region. I think this itself increases stability for all of Europe. And if Europe is stable, that's also relieving for the Americans.
That is one heck of a case. Mina, let's close out with your take on this. What, in your mind, does Finland bring to NATO?
All of what was said already, very, very good overview by Henry. And I would maybe really emphasize this point that at the Madrid summit last July, NATO pledged to defend all allied territory, every inch of allied territory at all times. That's a bold pledge. Actually, NATO would be quite hard-pressed to deliver on that, especially in the Baltic region, without Finland and Sweden in the alliance. And I would like to emphasize also that it's both Finland and Sweden. And it's very crucial that also Sweden becomes member, because if you look at the map, Swedish territory is so crucial, like as like kind of connecting the whole region, like from the Arctic down to the southern Baltic Sea, and especially for the southern Baltic states, Lithuania and Latvia, Swedish territory is extremely important for security of supply and strategic depth of their defense. So that should be also emphasized. And then on the Finnish side, I would maybe also like to just add this Finnish comprehensive security concept. In Finland, we have an extremely well-functioning civil-military cooperation. And that is actually also quite a rare... this is a common Nordic concept of like how to view security, because especially like Finland, Sweden, and Norway all have large territories but small populations. And that necessitates this kind of civil-military cooperation in order to organize defense in an effective way. So I think that will be also an interesting aspect that Finland brings on the table to NATO, especially now that we need more of this more comprehensive integrated security thinking, because Russia is not only a military threat, but also a cyber and hybrid threat in many ways. So understanding how all this plays together, not only the three traditional domains, air, land, and sea, but also newer domains such as space and cyber. So these are some things that definitely Finland can also contribute to. And I think that is actually one of the very interesting parts of Finland's doctrine, that the military defense is actually only the tip of the iceberg also, although that is a very important part of it.
Excellent, excellent point. And in the tradition in this conversation of giving shout outs to previous publications, I'll give one more, which is on your points about the importance of incorporating Sweden, both for Finnish defense and for full alliance interoperability, especially in the case of a crisis. I'll point people, Mina, to your article from earlier this week on Lawfare, Incomplete Without Sweden. And with that, I will thank both of you for joining us for this conversation. It won't be the last, and I'm grateful that you found the time to come on. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Remember to get ad-free versions of this and some other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. Remember to also listen to our other podcasts, Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath. And check out our written work, as always, at lawfareblog.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Pacha-Howell. Your audio engineer this episode was me. Our music is performed, as always, by Sophia Yan. Thank you for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.